This week on The Score, a new year brings a new Congress, a government shutdown, and an unsteady White House. Silicon Valley wants regulation, or doesn't want it. Which is it? We have highlights from 2018. All this and more on The Score. Don't go away.
You're listening to The Score from Bering Drift with your host, Rick Sincere.
The new year, 2019, began with a new Congress. Here's how the 116th Congress opened in the House of Representatives on Thursday, January 3rd.
The chair declares the 115th Congress adjourned. Sine die.
The tellers agree in their tallies that the total number of votes cast is 430, of which the Honorable Nancy Pelosi of the state of California has received 220. The Honorable Kevin McCarthy of the state of California has received 192. The Honorable Jim Jordan of the state of Ohio has received 5. The Honorable Sherry Bustos of the state of Illinois has received 4. The Honorable Tammy Duckworth of the state of Illinois has received 2. The Honorable Stacey Abrams of the state of Georgia has received 1. The Honorable Joseph Biden of the state of Delaware has received 1. The Honorable Marsha Fudge of the state of Ohio has received 1. The Honorable Joseph P. Kennedy III of the state of Massachusetts has received 1. The Honorable John Lewis of the state of Georgia has received 1. The Honorable Thomas Massey of the state of Kentucky has received 1. The Honorable Stephanie Murphy of the state of Florida has received 1, with 3 recorded as present. Therefore, the Honorable Nancy Pelosi of the state of California, having received a majority of the votes cast, is duly elected Speaker of the House of Representatives for the 116th Congress.
Will you all please raise your right hand? Do you solemnly swear that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that you take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties of the office on which you are about to enter, so help you God? Congratulations, you are now. House will be in order. Congratulations, you are now all members of the 116th Congress.
Later in the show, we'll have excerpts from old interviews with new congressmen and others as well. Welcome back to The Score from Bering Drift. I'm your host, Rick Sincere. Happy New Year! Ken Hughes is a historian of the presidency at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. As Nancy Pelosi gaveled in the House of Representatives on Thursday, I asked him what we might expect from Congress in 2019, what lessons we might learn from previous government shutdowns, and what we should remember from the beginning of Richard Nixon's administration, 50 years ago this month. We talked by telephone. We're at a new year, a new Congress. What do you know from the past that might portend for the future, for the new democratically controlled Congress, which has had the largest number of new Democratic members since the Watergate Congress of 1974?
I expect that the word investigation will be very prominent this year. They're not going to make any predictions, but like you said, back in 74, when there was a new crop of freshmen elected right on the heels of Watergate, Congress became a very investigative body, looking for corruption and wrongdoing in all parts of the executive branch. And I think that this crop of freshmen is just as eager to do the same, because these are moral, ethical, and policy questions that have been dominating for the last couple of years, and they now have a chance to get answers to them. So that's what I do expect they will at first attempt to do, and probably will succeed in doing.
We're speaking with Ken Hughes, who's a historian at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. And Ken, you've researched a lot and done a lot of writing on the Nixon administration in the 1970s. It was about the mid-1970s when the budget process changed. The fiscal year shifted from the beginning of July to the beginning of October, and yet more and more, it seems Congress is incapable of passing a budget in time for the beginning of the fiscal year. And right now we're in the middle of a government shutdown, in part because of that. What do you know from past government shutdowns that we might learn about how they will affect policy and the progress of budgetary considerations?
Government shutdowns, I think, are largely political events designed to score political points. I don't know when President Trump will both back down and declare victory, but I suspect he will, because the government does have to be funded and does have to reopen. And I also think that since it's a political matter, at this point the politics are just not in his favor. I don't think necessarily that President Trump even expects to get funding to build a wall on our southern border. I think that it is a rallying issue for his base of support, and he feels at this point rather threatened due to the most recent election returns and the Democratic takeover of the House, and is, I think, doing what he can to prove to his most enthusiastic supporters that he's still with them. So this will go on for as long as he thinks it takes for him to make that point.
The comparisons that are made between Donald Trump and Richard Nixon are many and variable, but you spend a lot of time trying to scrutinize somewhat inscrutable tapes, recordings that take place in the White House in the Nixon years and prior to that. But Donald Trump seems to be someone who does not have an unspoken thought. Historians of the future are going to be looking at his Twitter feed rather than trying to figure out what was going on in the White House behind closed doors. But what's going on in the White House, many people are describing as chaotic. Is there any precedent for a time when there's an acting attorney general, an acting secretary of defense? I think there's an acting secretary of the interior. More than half of U.S. embassies do not have ambassadors appointed 2 years into an administration. Is there any precedent for that?
Well, first I want to say thank you for giving us in the White House Tapes program a new slogan, scrutinizing the inscrutable. That definitely works for me. The chaos of the Trump administration is... It's worse than previous administrations is the only way I can put it. Yes, there have been people in acting capacities running important agencies before, but previous presidents have stressed the importance of filling those positions with Senate-confirmed people. And I think in the case of President Trump, we're not seeing so much a policy as sort of a defensive reaction. He is, as far as, you know, the Justice Department is concerned, very worried about the investigations of the various organizations of which he has been a part. And he's currently got a loyalist there. And it is disturbing for those of us who are committed to preserving the rule of law to have somebody in that position who has not been confirmed by the Senate, who does not have the customary qualifications for the job, and who has already tipped his hand with regard to his bias in favor of President Trump on important issues related to the rule of law. I think we've, while we've seen chaos in the Trump administration from day one, we're kind of in a more worrisome stage where some of the more experienced voices and heads within the administration are on their way out. And all of them, in one way or another, had a tempering effect on the president's impulses, which you referred to earlier by referring that by saying that he seems to have no unuttered thought. So at this point, there is less offsetting influence from people who have experience in government, in the military, even in politics, with the departure of Jeff Sessions from the Justice Department. And so we're going to see more of the presidential impulses turned into action. And that is concerning for everybody who understands the importance of presidential policy and would like to see it made in some sort of orderly and rational fashion.
I have two more questions for you. And the first one is, what was your reaction when you heard that the president spent time in a cabinet meeting defending the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan of 1979?
Hilarity. I mean, there's that, you know, it was wrongheaded, but it caused no harm. It was just funny. You know, I was a young man at the time of the invasion of Afghanistan, and we in no way considered it a justified or good thing. And of course, while it was harmful to the Soviet Union, it did not bring about Glasnost or Perestroika or the rise of Mikhail Gorbachev. Those were all the results of internal contradictions within the Soviet system and the rise of an exceptional leader in Gorbachev. And it is those things, along with, you know, the both supportive and challenging policies of the Reagan and Bush administrations, to which we owe the demise of the Soviet Union. But, you know, I was grateful for a little comic relief.
Finally, I'd hate to have you on the line without asking you about this. We're 50 years minus a couple of months from the election of Richard Nixon. A couple weeks from now would be the 50th anniversary of his inauguration as president. What should Americans be thinking about now in terms of the beginning of the Nixon administration, which you know so well?
Well, the most interesting thing I found about the Nixon administration and Watergate was that when Nixon took power 50 years ago this month, he already had a major crime he was trying to cover up, the crime he committed in order to win the 1968 election. It was relatively unknown at the time, and even for decades after, you know, it wasn't even investigated very much during Watergate. But he did collude with the South Vietnamese government to thwart President Lyndon Johnson's attempts to start peace talks to end the Vietnam War. And that was a crime. It violated an obscure law that's been on the books for over 200 years, but remains the law of the land. The Logan Act makes it a felony to interfere with presidential negotiations. And the record of the Nixon administration shows that he was sort of obsessed with making sure that what he had done to win the election never came to light. And in the book Chasing Shadows, which you referred to, trace all the ways in which his attempts to keep that secret backfired and led him to do unwise and self-destructive things, like create the Plumbers, this special investigations unit in the White House, sort of a secret police unit, to commit crimes against his political enemies. And the plumbers, as we all know, eventually gave way to the team. The plumbers first brought together the team that masterminded the Watergate break-in. So Nixon's attempts to preserve himself wound up undoing himself. And everything he did to hold on to the presidency wound up costing him the presidency. I would not suggest that history repeats itself in any sort of neat parallel, but it's worth looking at. One thing I want to say as far as expectations for the years go, I think the Democrats are not going to be eager to start impeachment proceedings, partly on a matter of principle and partly on a matter of math. The incoming Judiciary Committee Chairman, Nadler, has said that there's no point in trying to impeach a president unless a significant share of his own party thinks that it is appropriate to do so. In part, you know, that is a approach that will promote stability in our politics. Impeachment is a last resort, not a first resort. And it's also a matter of simple arithmetic. As long as President Trump has 34 Republican senators on his side, he is going to remain in office, because it takes two-thirds of the Senate to convict a president and remove him from office. So I think while we're going to see a lot of investigations, and those will be important, I don't think we're going to be barreling toward impeachment. But I insist that is not a prediction. The news of tomorrow could very well change everything.
Well, I'll just say that I agree with you on that. I think the math is not there. And just as in policy areas, it's important to have bipartisan, if not consensus, at least good overlap when you're pursuing issues like this.
I think so, too. And that's what we saw during the Nixon administration. The House and the Senate moved very deliberately, amassed a whole lot of evidence, and the Republicans really only started coming out in favor of impeachment when two things happened. When direct evidence of the president's own criminality became public, and the second, which was also important, was that their primaries were over in 1974, and they were approaching the general election, and they saw that to some extent their political survival would depend the president resigning. So there are just a lot of moving pieces.
Last year, The Score featured interviews with a number of candidates for Congress in Virginia, as well as sitting members of the House and Senate. I tried to ask each of them the same set of questions. One question I posed was, what should be the direction of U.S. policy toward Africa, noting that China is investing billions of dollars there? In this series of excerpts from earlier interviews, we start with Senator Tim Kaine, a member of the Foreign Relations Committee. He'll be followed by his rivals for office last year, Republican Corey Stewart and Libertarian Matt Waters. Then we'll hear from 6th District Congressman Bob Goodlatte and his successor, Ben Klein, as well as Klein's opponent last year, Jennifer Lewis. Then candidate Denver Riggleman, now representing Virginia's 5th District in Washington, and his opponent, journalist Leslie Coburn.
We're in a period of now of disinvestment and disengagement, but China is becoming much more engaged. There's a piece in one of the press this morning about how the Chinese have essentially rebuilt Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, and our absence does not mean that everybody's absent. So I think the U.S. has to decide if we want to cede influence in these parts of the world to China, or whether we want to be a player. Many of these heads of state, they would very much like us involved, because they kind of see that China is very mercantile, like, what's in it for us, do a deal, then they're in hock to China. They'd rather have us, but if we're not going to be involved, they'll do deals with China.
Well, the Chinese have been gobbling up resources in sub-Saharan Africa, cutting deals, and you know, sub-Saharan Africa is a critical region for rare minerals and natural resources. The United States has to be, you know, we need to utilize the private sector to much more aggressively work out better relationships with the region.
The United States government should mostly stay out of the business of America, right? I mean, I think businesses need to make those decisions and look at investment over there. I know there's several nonprofits. I'll take World Hope International is doing work in Sierra Leone right now. They're working with the government of Sierra Leone to do water projects and plant, do fruit and agricultural industry stuff. So I would certainly not favor necessarily the government being involved as much as humanly possible. But, you know, the fact is the Chinese government is involved. They are involved in the industry. And the fact that we have to go toe-to-toe with a communist government that is centralized in its planning, it owns everything. There's really not a free market in China. So I think we're comparing apples and oranges.
We should be doing the same things we have been doing, and that is pointing out to them that China's loan-to-own policy, which you can see, for example, in Sri Lanka, not an African nation, but island off of India there, where China loaned them a lot of money, built a port for them, and now since they can't pay them back, China's going to own that port. That's what will happen all over the world if people do business with the Chinese. On the other hand, what we do is we help lift people up by our health care programs. We've done more to stop HIV/AIDS in Africa than any other nation, thanks to the initiative begun by President Bush that's still continuing on, and making sure that people have the kind of help that they need to better their own lives, not big, high-profile infrastructure projects like that. Secondly, the United States needs to pay great attention, Americans do, to what China is doing in Beijing today, because what they're doing is using money that they got from the United States with this gross trade imbalance, and they're using it to try to buy friends and access and influence in other parts of the world.
China is aggressive globally. They are where we can work with them. We want to, but we should not view them as a friend. In Africa, they are trying to set up placeholders all around Africa, including bases, but also economic ties. We need to be in there competing because Africa is economic opportunity for American jobs, American business, and we need to seize that and be as competitive as we can over there.
Well, so I believe that we should be doing diplomacy everywhere around the world. That's how we repair our name, and I think that that's how we build coalitions. So anything that we're doing with other countries in a supportive way is something I very much support. Because that's when we can show that we can all work together for a common goal that unites us all. The division that we all have in today's political world, when we can unite behind one mission and work towards that goal, it's great to see the outcome of that, but it's also great to just work on those relationships with folks and partner up with people.
It's almost like a new domino theory thing you got going on, right, with infrastructure growth. And I think what you're saying is that when you talk about national priorities, you talk about these hegemonic powers that are trying to do certain things differently. I don't think it's about taking territory anymore when it comes to military. I think it's about taking economic territory. It's also what you're seeing in Syria a little bit, too. So when you see this infrastructure investment that's going into these certain areas where China wants to actually have markets, I believe at some point you're going to see other countries following suit. And I even think you might see the United States say, hey, maybe we invest there in infrastructure because maybe we have a market there also. I think that's something that might happen in the future.
Well, China is very active in Africa. I've certainly seen it close up where they come into a country and they will build a system of roads, they'll build a new port, and they'll extract whatever they can from that country. I think that the U.S. should be highly competitive, and I think that we should have a positive commercial role with African countries. And I think we should watch very closely what China's doing around the world, not just in Africa, so that we don't find ourselves suddenly in a position where China owns everything on the planet. They are very aggressive right now. So if the U.S. wants to be a world power, we too should be aggressive, but not in a sense of battling China. We can do it in a very sensible way of being better business partners. And there are lots of ways to be better business partners in Africa. For example, the Chinese tend to bring in all Chinese workers. United States can go in and say, we want to use Kenyan workers, or we want to use Nigerian workers, and not and have a more of a partnership. The more you do that, the better off you are.
Happy New Year from The Score with Rick Sincere.
On New Year's Eve, I spoke to telecommunications attorney Drew Clark about regulations that affect the tech industry. He recently wrote about how Silicon Valley's attempts to get more government oversight may backfire on the tech giants like Google and Facebook. I spoke to Drew by telephone. My first question is, what's the status of government regulation of the internet today? What position are we in?
Sure. Thanks, Rick, for allowing me to be on your show here. We are at a moment where all of these incredible benefits of the technology revolution over the past 20 years is potentially threatened by an array of forces from so-called progressive to populist, nationalist. There's kind of everyone's gunning for the tech industry right now. And for that reason, there's a very real fear in the air among Silicon Valley companies, technology companies, internet companies, that Washington is about to take a huge bite out of their business models.
We're speaking with telecommunications attorney Drew Clark, who's the publisher of BroadbandBreakfast.com, and he recently wrote a piece for the Cato Institute about Silicon Valley and how its desire for regulation may backfire on it. Is that a good way of characterizing your piece?
Yeah, it already has backfired on them. I mean, the last year and a half, but particularly, you know, the last 12 months have seen an incredible acceleration of the areas in which all kinds of forces are gunning after Google and Facebook and Twitter and even Amazon for all manner of alleged sins, mainly having to do with being big, successful companies, right, that have driven a lot of the prosperity of the last two decades.
There's a pattern in business that as companies become bigger and more dominant in their fields, they actually request regulation by the government as a way of keeping possible competitors out of the market. Is that what's going on with the tech firms in Silicon Valley?
I think you could definitely argue it that way. You know, the tech companies would probably just as soon not have new extensive regulation. Let's just take privacy, for example. That is much discussed, and I think it's quite likely that we will see major momentum, if not a concrete bill in the next Congress. And the reason is simply on privacy legislation, for example. The reason simply it's a very complicated topic, and it's going to require a lot of vetting, a lot of stakeholders. But when that bill kind of comes forward and begins to roll, I don't think you're going to see a Google, a Facebook, a Microsoft opposing that. They're going to be all behind it. They're going to be supporting it. They're going to be, hey, let's help you draft this. And yes, you're totally right, Rick. That is and has the effect of this age-old practice of big companies using regulation to capture and keep the next generation of companies from competing, growing to the point that they can successfully compete with them.
On the topic of privacy regulation, are the companies going to be wanting to see the U.S. regulations or U.S. legislation to match what's been going on in Europe?
No, that raises a whole new can of worms, and I didn't deal as extensively in my piece with that segment. What you have on the privacy front is you have the European Union having a very different approach to privacy traditionally than the United States, and really with the GDRP, Global Data Protection Regulation or Rules, I can't recall which, you have seen for the first time, really, American companies having to take seriously a European privacy mandate because it was written in such a way that it would require even U.S. companies that were offering services to European to allow them to, you know, have the disclosure and notice that is required for Europeans. Many companies just went ahead and applied that for everyone. So you've got the European framework, and there's also, not to be confused or not to be forgotten, a California privacy framework. And so both of those are kind of pinching, and I think that's going to put lots and lots of pressure on Congress and the industry to do regulation. But let me just step back a second, though, and I don't know if you're going to ask about this right away, Rick, but you have to look at what the European Union is doing in privacy against the context of the European Union's aggressive inquiries into tech companies, particularly Google and Amazon and Apple. There's incredible amounts, I mean, basically three separate, cases against Google, each of which have resulted in, multi-billion-dollar fines, which Google is appealing. That's got to be seen in the backdrop for this kind of war on American tech that Europe is really engaged in a full-fronted battle on, and many American progressives particularly are basically going and saying, yeah, amen, brother, that's what we should be doing too. And really, that's in one of the fragments driving the pressure on the tech companies right now.
And let's suppose that the U.S. Congress passes some kind of privacy legislation that doesn't exactly match the GDPR model of Europe. That means that tech companies will have to be dealing with two different kinds of regulatory regimes that may contradict each other.
Well, absolutely. And this is really, the way the world works. I mean, car manufacturers, for example, already have to deal with separate regimes for safety and a regulation in America on the one, North America on the one hand, and Europe on the other. And so they end up basically doing two models of their cars for one market or the other. And yes, it does put pressure, but in some ways that's less of a burden than it would be if they had to deal with 50 different sets of regulation, which is what we will see when states like California begin to pass strong privacy rules. And that in turn becomes yet another incentive for the big tech companies to argue for privacy rules so that they can preempt state rules.
And of course, the U.S. Constitution says that Congress has the right to regulate commerce between states. And the whole idea is for some kind of uniformity in regulations of interstate commerce. And the internet is interstate. There's no way you can keep it within one state.
Well, this raises another issue we haven't yet talked about here, Rick, which is, and this is probably the primary thread in the piece I wrote for the Cato Institute, Seeking Intervention Backfire on Silicon Valley. It's the net neutrality rule. And if I can take a minute or two just to outline this, Rick, I'd love, because it really is a context for all these other issues we've talked about. So net neutrality is the principle that content should be freely available without regard to your internet service provider. So your ISP, like your Verizon or your AT&T or Comcast, or maybe you've got a smaller local wireless internet service provider, or even a municipal run service provider, those internet service providers have largely, almost, I'd have to say, the number of exceptions to this rule you can really count on your hands, these ISPs do not throttle or block or discriminate against a individual internet user's ability to get at a website or a web service that they want to have access to on the internet. Now, just the thought that they might block this, or again, these handful of instances where there has been a kind of a quote violation of net neutrality are enough to get a lot of people exercised, a lot of people concerned. And so literally for the past 14 years, we have been fighting over net neutrality rules. And the first versions of this were very timid and tame and weren't so onerous to the industry. And then when even those rules that the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, put forward were struck down by a court and sent back to the FCC, the agency said, well, we actually are going to put some real strong rules on here. And this is where you get to, is an internet and telecom company more like a regulatory utility or more like a information entity that is free from regulation. That was the issue that the FCC was wrestling with about 3-4 years ago, and they ultimately decided to do a whole volley of regulations against internet service providers, aided and abetted by Silicon Valley. I mean, that's really kind of the thrust for what's happening now. Is it was in 2014, 2015 that Silicon Valley said, okay, I know the FCC, you're talking about a mild form of net neutrality rules that wouldn't reclassify internet providers as Title II common carriers. I know you're talking about something that won't do that, but we, Silicon Valley, we, the tech companies like Google and Mozilla and Netflix, really feel like you should put your boot down on the ISPs because they are very monopolistic and they have the power to really discriminate against users' ability to see content. And so we really urge you, government, Obama administration, to take a very strong regulatory action against the ISPs. And lo and behold, that is in fact what the Obama administration did in February 2015. They put forward these strong rules and they were despised, and they were a big deterrent to investment by the internet service providers. And so really that became, you know, the gun for a target. And as soon as the 2016 elections came to pass and Republicans took over at the FCC, their first order of business was reversing those rules. They did reverse those rules a year ago, December 2017. And now we are in a world where there is, dun, 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 no net neutrality protection. And because of that, there's no problem, right? People are not experiencing net neutrality violations because, by and large, ISPs are totally willing to abide by these general rules, but they don't want to be regulated. And that's the backlash. That is what has caused one aspect of this huge backlash that we are seeing right now against the Googles, the Facebooks, and so forth.
Well, we could talk about this for hours. Unfortunately, we only have about 30 seconds left. But one of the aspects of regulating the internet, as it were, is that it doesn't really fit into a traditional model of antitrust or anti-monopoly, because so many of these services are provided to the consumer for free. And there's no monopoly pricing, as it were. How does this affect the regulatory regimes in Congress or, you know, in state capitals?
Well, thanks, Rick, and I know we definitely could keep talking about this. Let me just answer that question by concluding on the antitrust note, which is the other big piece or section of the piece I wrote for the Cato Institute on the intervention backfiring against Silicon Valley. Antitrust has, for the past 40 years, been guided by what's called the consumer welfare standard. And the consumer welfare standard insists that it is that antitrust law needs to be aimed to benefit consumers and not rival companies, because often rival companies attempt to use competition law and antitrust law as a way to go against their big competitor. Witness Microsoft antitrust case 15 years ago. That was clearly a big factor in the case against Microsoft. Well, now what you're seeing is that because all of these Silicon Valley giants, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon's not really Silicon Valley, but I kind of lump them in as the big tech company, those companies are all being criticized on antitrust / competition grounds, and yet they all fight for and do things that clearly benefit the consumers. And so what you're beginning to see in antitrust circles is a whole new school of thought that's basically arguing, actually, we want something besides the consumer welfare standard. We want something that benefits, quote, competition or the competitive process. And that just opens the gates to a whole new level of intervention against the tech companies that, unfortunately, you're seeing both so-called conservatives, populists, even the Trump administration and Donald Trump himself has said things that suggest he'd love to see more antitrust prosecution of these big tech companies, those companies, that political force, and the Elizabeth Warren, who's just announced for president in 2020, those people, those quote progressives, they are the other force that's really pinching against the tech industry. So right now they're under the gun from all sides, from everything from antitrust to privacy to net neutrality to other issues that we're going to see are really points of contention and will be for 2019 and for a long time to come.
Well, the telecommunications field seems to have some fascinating challenges ahead of it. And I'm sure that as a telecom lawyer, you see it as sort of an intellectual feast. But Drew Clark, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. I'm glad we have this chance to get together by telephone. And I want to wish you a happy new year.
Well, thanks very much. And don't forget to check out broadbandbreakfast.com for more insights and news about the tech industry and its competitors.
We will do that. Thanks again.
Happy New Year from The Score with Rick Sincere.
Over the course of 2018, I had the opportunity to interview dozens of authors of new books on politics, history, science, and other topics. Here are some highlights, starting with Maren McKenna on her book, Big Chicken.
Big Chicken is the story of how we came to give antibiotics routinely to most of the meat animals on the planet, and how we discovered that was a terrible idea, a source of profound antibiotic resistance. And it's a story wrapped in the story of how we got the meat production system that we have today. And it turns out that chicken is uniquely important to that story because chickens were the first animals to get antibiotics experimentally as a growth promoter supplement after World War II. Chicken effectively taught the rest of agriculture how to misuse antibiotics. And it turns out in the United States, chicken is the first sort of sector of the protein economy that's turning away from routine antibiotic use. So chicken, as it taught agriculture to make that historic mistake, is now teaching agriculture how to reverse that mistake as well.
Well, it's not a get-rich-quick scheme, but even with the limited federal research legalization, the industry is growing by double digits, and it's providing farmers who cultivate it successfully and are willing to be in it for the long haul with significantly better returns than sort of the big three of corn, wheat, soy.
What can you make from hemp?
Boy, there's so well. I'll just describe the low-hanging fruit. There's three parts of the plant: the flowering part, the seed, and the fiber. The seed is a superfood. The fiber goes into things like hemp building materials, animal bedding, and next generation battery components and supercapacitors. And the flower has cannabinoids in it, components of the plant, though. What we call hemp today doesn't have significant amounts of the psychoactive component THC. It has components of other components of the plant, such as CBD, which are showing really good sort of health maintenance and other benefits, and that's a big market today.
So my sense, I think, is that the some of the disruptive protests, for example, are more common at a lot of elite institutions, often sort of smaller liberal arts colleges. They seem a little less common at some other places. It's hard to know exactly why. I suspect part of it, for example, is the difference between more residential universities and places that are less residential, where you have more commuters and the like. They're just going to be less engaged on that kind of stuff in general. Students are a little more focused on actually just getting through their studies at, for example, a community college in ways that may be less true at a Millbury, for example, and that has consequences. But those places have their own problems, and so there certainly are episodes of speakers being disinvited from those places, of people organizing to discourage controversial people coming to campus. There are lots of instances of faculty getting fired from those campuses. They often rely upon non-tenured faculty to do teaching in a lot of those places, and those people are often very vulnerable to being fired when they say something controversial. In some ways, that's more of a problem at those institutions than it is at some of these elite institutions where a higher fraction of the faculty are tenured and thus harder to fire. And so so the way in which the problem of free speech expresses itself is different. But I think there are often their own set of problems at often less visible kinds of campuses and not just the Middleburys of the world.
Well, it's kind of a mystery as to why he was underestimated, because Eisenhower was the most popular man in America for the entire 8 years that he was in office. He was the most successful general that America came out of the Second World War with. He was a charismatic, dynamic figure, but the press thought of him as something of an unsophisticated figure, and they kind of mocked him for his sort of homely ways and his lack of sophistication. And then his political enemies also were very clever in depicting him as old, out of date, especially John Kennedy, when he started running for the presidency in the late 50s, he talked about the generational gap between the new America that he envisioned and the old America that Eisenhower stood for. And once that got onto Eisenhower, it sort of stuck, and he became seen as old and sick and yesterday's man and tired and so forth. I think that was a terrible mistake, and now we see him, you know, 50, 60 years later in quite a different light.
The concern I have about third parties is there's a conception that those are people in the middle, but often people leave their party because they don't feel they're extreme enough, so they'll become an independent because they feel like their party has left them. Then you have people, Greens, Libertarians, Reform Party members, so I support giving them a voice, and I don't want to dilute their influence, but I do think that by the theory of creating a third party of centrists, the concern I have about that is people would leave the two parties, and then the Republicans and Democrats would have no incentive to appeal to that group because they're not part of their base. At the presidential level, a third party is a long road, and the problem is you have to win a majority of the electoral process of the electoral votes. And if you don't do that, it goes to the House of Representatives, who almost certainly would choose the majority party in the House. So unless at the national level, unless you have a candidate that can somehow win a majority of the electoral votes, it's going to do more harm than good, I think.
Well, it's not just right wing. It's left wing, too. They'll support anyone who's on the fringes, I would say. They want to support the fringe at the expense of the center. And it's strange because if you grew up during the Cold War, you know, in the Soviet Union was supporting communists and Marxist-Leninism around the world. And now mostly they are supporting some form of kind of right-wing reactionary. So it is a little strange, but then you realize that they're doing it because they want to basically break up the post-war world order, liberal world order that the United States constructed after World War II, namely in the form of NATO and the European Union. And so you see support for Marine Le Pen in France. They supported Brexit in the UK. They have connections to the Alternative for Deutschland, the far-right party in Germany, Golden Dawn in Greece. Basically, you know, the whole goes down the line. But I wouldn't want to... I think what's really worrisome about this is that these parties aren't pro-Russian because they get Russian money or because they get, you know, time on Russian propaganda outlets. There's a real natural affinity, I think, for Vladimir Putin and what he stands for and represents that would be there even if there wasn't Russian money flowing to these parties. And I even think with Donald Trump, you know, I'm skeptical of the collusion thesis. I certainly think it's possible that there might be Russian money floating around in Donald Trump's businesses and that explains his odd affinity for Vladimir Putin. I think it's just as explainable by the fact that Donald Trump admires Vladimir Putin and sees in him a kindred soul. And I think we've seen among Republican voters, we've seen a real dramatic shift on Vladimir Putin and Russia. They've become more pro-Putin and pro-Russian. And I think that has to do with real ideological reasons for that. We can't just wave it away as being all money, you know, and if we just shut off the bank accounts, then it'll just go away. I think this is a real challenge to, you know, liberal democracy that we're dealing with.
That last excerpt was Jamie Kirchick, author of The End of Europe, talking about Russian interference in Western democracies. He was preceded by Maren McKenna on poultry and antibiotics, Doug Fine on industrial hemp, Keith Whittington on free speech, William Hitchcock on Dwight Eisenhower, and former Congressman Jason Altmaier on third parties in American politics. Since we heard from politicians about Africa earlier in the show, I thought I'd go back in the archives to get the views of an economist. Carol Boudreau spoke at the University of Virginia in November 2013 when I had this conversation with her. Note that she talks about the impact on cell phones in Africa, which brings us around to this week's interview with Drew Clark about the tech industry. From the archives, here's Carol Boudreau.
Carol Boudreau, you were talking about what were the barriers to economic growth in Africa in the past and how those barriers are being overcome today. Could you just kind of summarize for people who may not be familiar with the situation, what's going on now?
Sure. So some tremendous changes are going on the ground in sub-Saharan Africa today. And a couple of the most important changes have been a real focus on reducing regulatory barriers to make it easier to do business for the entrepreneurs, the millions of entrepreneurs who are otherwise stymied. stymied in African countries. Many countries have adopted new macroeconomic policies that have led to much lower inflation rates, that have made the money supply a bit more stable, that have done things like privatize businesses that were run by the government, introducing a more competitive environment into these economies. So more competition, lower costs of doing business, more stable money supply has really contributed to improvements on the ground.
One of the major differences between Africa today and 20 years ago is the existence of cell phones and cell phone networks.
Yeah.
Can you address how that's changed the economy on the ground?
Sure. It really has been a dramatic change. Having the cell phone technology on the ground has meant that people have had a whole new tool that they can use in creative, interesting ways. So cell phones are used to send information about crop prices. They're used to send information about medical care. They're used for entertainment. They're used to transfer money supplies. Every one of those different issues then, or every one of those different activities, is creating jobs, leading to competitors trying to do more, do better, transfer money faster, provide education over cell phones, provide a whole variety of other sorts of information and connections. And so in important ways, it really has changed the nature of Africa.
This may be a question you haven't encountered before, but do you think there will be a major impact by Francophone countries like Rwanda and Gabon adopting English as a medium of instruction in their schools?
That's a really interesting question. I think it'll make the French even more irritated than they already are. They're sort of irritated.
That goes without saying.
Of course. If I were better, I would do a Monty Python quote here from Holy Grail, but I'm not good at that. Yeah, so it shifts the focus of attention in those countries towards English-speaking consumers, and so you see things in Rwanda, like call centers being set up to service Great Britain. I think less so to service the United States, but I can easily imagine in 10 years Rwanda being a back office for a whole variety of English-speaking countries, and that's good for the Rwandans who have those new jobs that otherwise didn't exist.
Well, speaking of call centers, you mentioned in your lecture that China is investing a lot in Africa. What about India?
Yes. So thank you for mentioning that. India is investing. Some of the investment has been in extractives, but a significant amount of Indian investment is in agribusiness, actually, in having access to land to grow a variety of crops, and then process the production and send the crops either back to India or elsewhere in the world. So Indians are very involved, for example, in cashew production, increasingly involved in production in South Sudan, especially in Ethiopia, in the ag sector.
Final question.
Yes, sir.
I was going over the agenda for the African Studies Association meeting next week, and there aren't a lot of free market economists or political scientists who seem to be working on Africa. How does that impact the way Americans think about Africa and the way government agencies react to Africa in terms of looking at the economies there?
That's a really interesting question. I think Americans tend not to think about very many places outside of America. So I'm not sure how many Americans are thinking about Africa. But if they do think about Africa, I think it's mostly in a humanitarian sense. And it's a shame if Americans don't recognize that the tremendous potential in African countries and the tremendous potential of the entrepreneurs. And if the vision or the message or the narrative that they're listening to is things are bad and we need smart people to fix them, what they're not recognizing then is that very smart people in Africa are already starting to fix the problems. And I wish that message were conveyed more frequently, that entrepreneurs on the ground in Africa are finding really creative ways to solve local problems. Right, that whole local knowledge issue, I think, tends to be overlooked in some of those debates. In development agencies themselves, I think there is a recognition that things are changing, and the recognition comes from the fact that the development agencies themselves may have a less central role to play, frankly. And they're feeling that reality. They're feeling that the private sector is growing and thriving, and so their place is they're not the central actors anymore, and that's a great thing for Africans.
Yeah, that's a good note to end
on. That's a really good note.
Appreciate your time. Thanks.
My pleasure.
Thanks.
That's all the time we have for the first episode of The Score for 2019. For all the writers and editors at Bering Drift, I'm Rick Sincere, wishing you a Happy New Year and reminding you to listen each week to the news, reviews, and interviews we have on The Score. Be sure to tell your friends where to find us, and feel free to talk back to us in the comments section on BeringDrift.com.
Do you have an idea for future episodes of The Score? Write to host Rick Sincere at RickSincere@gmail.com. The Score is produced by Bering Drift, Virginia's top site for news and politics. To learn more, visit BeringDrift.com.